we must restore meaning to the great ideas, partly conflicting ideas, by which mankind is still living. The ideas of liberalism, democracy, and communism. Yes, the idea of communism.
Hi, and welcome to Marxism in Our Time, a podcast of Marxist ideas and debate from the Deutscher Prize Committee. Many thanks for tuning in. The Deutscher Prize is an award given in honor of the memory and work of leftist intellectuals Tamara and Isaac Deutscher, and is awarded on a yearly basis to a book exemplifying the best and most innovative new writing in or about the Marxist tradition. My name is Vincent Harding, and in each episode I'll be joined by a different member of the prize committee, or fellow comrades, in hosting an author of a book that made it to our 2022 shortlist, to discuss the main themes of their work and its relation to Marxism. The winner of the prize in 2022 was Gabriel Winans' The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America, published by Harvard University Press, and he will deliver this year's Deutscher Lecture in November. But in this podcast, we will be discussing the other impressive books that made it to last year's shortlist, in a way that is accessible and can help to bring their core arguments to a wider audience than usual academic circles, thus providing valuable resources for the left. Today, for our final episode of the season, we're joined by Alex Colas, member of our committee and professor of international relations at Birkbeck University of London. And our guest is Kolya Lindner, presenting and discussing his book Marx, Marxism and the Question of Eurocentrism, published by Palgrave in 2022. Kolya Lindner is professor of German political theory at Paris 8 University and has written extensively on the problem of Eurocentrism in Marxist thought, as well as on other topics such as the hegemony politics of the French bourgeois right, secularism and political representation. Kolya, we're extremely pleased to have you over. And Alex, I will now hand it to you to kick off.
Welcome, Kolya Lindner, author of Marx, Marxism and the Question of Eurocentrism, one of the several books that have been shortlisted for this year's Isaac and Tamara Deutscher Prize. It's a great honor and a pleasure to be in conversation with you over this wonderful book, which covers work that you've conducted, sometimes with other colleagues throughout various years. And I wanted to start off by asking you about the plea that you make in the beginning of the book about the integration of post-colonial theory into Marx scholarship and Marxism as a tradition. And this is not an easy thing, an easy task, considering the disagreement that often exists between those various camps or those various traditions. So could you start by perhaps explaining what your concern was, what you were aiming to do in putting these three approaches, post-colonial theory, Marx scholarship, and Marxism, in conversation?
Sure, of course. So my book is a collection of essays that discuss Marx as well as Marxism's engagement with global affairs. And when I started working on that question in the late 2000s, I would say the debate was characterized by what I perceived as a quite unproductive confrontation between Marxists on the one hand and post-colonial theorists on the other. And at the heart of this tension was actually this question of Eurocentrism. So questions that were asked in this debate were, is Marx Eurocentric? And if so, what does this tell us about the viability of his work today? Or is the whole question of Eurocentrism somehow a misguided problem of postmodern rejections of universalism? And I really felt frustrated with this confrontation, especially as different participants in this debate did generally not agree on a common conception of Eurocentrism. And this is why my first paper on this issue differentiated between different aspects of Eurocentrism, and this essay is reproduced in the beginning of the book. And in this chapter, I identify four dimensions of Eurocentrism. The first one is a kind of naive ethnocentrism that presumes Western societies as superior on different fronts, politics, economy, philosophy, so forth. So the second dimension I identified in this debate was what went back to Edward Said's book on Orientalism. Said has this idea that Orientalism is a way of looking at non-Western societies that homogenizes and co-opts it. And following Said, this analysis is supported obviously by Western domination, by colonialism, and creates these quote unquote other regions of the world in the first place. A third dimension of Eurocentrism that is argued for in this debate is more concerned with the development of societies, and it's an idea of a development that is somehow falsely universalized, that falsely universalizes historical patterns of the capitalist Western Europe as somehow the standard of human development in all history. So following this view, the whole world should somehow develop or be developed following the Western European model. And the fourth and last dimension of Eurocentrism is an effacement of non-European history, or more precisely of its influence on European development. And this is especially what global history has focused on in the last 30 years or so. And the idea of this global history is obviously to elaborate a non-Eurocentric historiography that tries to carve out entangled history of modernity, thereby to provincialize European experience. So if we take this fourfold scheme of Eurocentrism and somehow look through it on Marx's work, we can see that these different dimensions of Eurocentrism are present in Marx's work, and they display in pretty diverse ways. As I tried to show, Marx was, when starting to engage seriously with global affairs in the early 50s when he came to London, was pretty Eurocentric in all the senses I just described, especially in his, and those have been much debated in the post-colonial debate, in his 1853 essays on English colonialism in India. Marx considers European societies superior on all fronts, and he also grounds his assessment on Orientalist sources in the sense of what Said. And he also elevates particularistic historical development to the rank of the universal. And finally, also in the sense of global history, he conceives of global interactions as a pretty one-sided influence of Europe on the non-Western world. So against the background of these four dimensions present in Marx's early essays on colonialism in India, it seems to me pretty obvious that post-colonial critics are completely right in rejecting Marx's approach. But where they are wrong is when they draw conclusions from these essays to the whole of Marx's work, as Marx not only became aware of different forms of Eurocentrism, but also managed to overcome them. And I was arguing in my first paper on this issue in the first chapter of the book, that there is a successive break with Eurocentrism, and that this successive break is rooted in especially in reading of more accurate and realistic sources on the non-Western world, but also a critical interrogation of philosophy of history, and also a growing awareness of global entanglements, as Marx himself started engaging more closely with social structures and political struggles in the colonized and the non-European world. And this is how, at least as in my reconstruction, by the end of his intellectual production in the late 1870s or early 1880s, Marx is no longer the Eurocentric thinker he used to be 30 years earlier. So my overall argument is that to detect this intellectual and also political development, of course, a differentiated discussion on what Eurocentrism is and a comprehensive account of Marx's work is pretty much needed. And unfortunately, Marxism as well as postcolonial theory, often, at least in the past, failed to do both of these things. And this is where this unproductive confrontation came from.
So we're going to pick up on a few of those things, but that's really helpful. I mean, it's a great survey. It covers a lot of the trajectory of Marx and indeed in a different way Engels themselves. In the second chapter of the book, the second essay, you write with Urs Linder. I mean, I assume that there's a family connection there. No,
there's none. There's none.
That's fantastic. None. You just happen to good share
friends,
a surname.
But, yeah.
That's fantastic. So in that chapter with Urs, you have a very a title which is provocative, How Marx Got Rid of Historical Materialism. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to make such a provocative statement? I mean, the invention of historical materialism is for many the contribution of Marx to social science, social theory is this theory of or this method of historical materialism. So it's quite a big claim. So why do you think that, in contrast, it's Marx that overcomes historical materialism? He's not the father, as it were, but the theorist responsible for doing away with historical materialism.
Yeah, so obviously the title of this chapter I have co-authored with my friend Urs Lindner, it's not my brother, is obviously pretty provoking. But so our argument expands on the development of Marx's thought I was already touching a little bit on. So according to us, historical materialism is not the whole of Marx's work, but it's a particular theory of history, which is important as generations of Marxists have advocated for it. And here we particularly draw on G.A. Cohen's reconstruction in his book, Karl Marx's Theory of History, a Defense, and also on Marx's preface to a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy of 1859. So Cohen, in his book, distinguishes between what he calls a development thesis and a primacy thesis. So according to Cohen, the development thesis argues that productive forces tend to develop in history and to replace productivity, fettering structures and superstructures with fostering ones. Whereas the primacy thesis sees the productive forces accounting for the stability and change of economic structures and determined by those, the political, legal, and cultural superstructures. And together with those two theses, we have in Marx, at least in the late 1850s, three particular conceptions. So the first conception is a progressive succession in history of different modes of production. The second one is the idea of an adjustment of economic structures and political superstructures to the development of the productive forces that is mediated by class struggle. And third, there is this idea of privileged historical agents carrying out this adjustment, which is the bourgeoisie, the proletariat, and the British Empire. So why this whole view is problematic? Urs Lindner and I argue that historical materialism constitutes what we would call a functionalist theology, and that it grounds an anti-ethical orientation in Marx's thought, and that it is finally, coming back to what I said earlier, a Eurocentric theory. So first of all, the development thesis entails this idea of an ongoing historical tendency of the productive forces to grow. And it is clear that here historical materialism is pretty anachronistic as it projects a specific feature of the capitalist mode of production on the entire human history. In pre-capitalist history, there is no constant growth of the productive forces. The primacy thesis grounds an epistemological strategy that Robert Brenner had called techno-functionalism, And this means that speculative claims about the properties of superstructures to foster or to fetter the development of productive forces are made. So that is clearly a theoretical problem. The second problem of historical materialism is, as I mentioned earlier, its anti-ethical orientation. So historical materialism claims that what historical progress, at least in its last instance, will persist, and that therefore social critique does not need to develop proper normative or ethical standards. And this conception, and this is pretty obvious when you read Marx in the late 1840s and early 1850s, this conception goes along with a paternalism that confers to the proletariat a privileged historical position. So he has this idea that what needs to be done is not the outcome of a democratic deliberation, but a process supposedly established by the laws of history, and those who know those laws are entitled to lead those who have not recognized them or have not recognized them yet. It is clear that this idea of a historical mission is pretty problematic and can politically fuel lots of bad ideas. And the third problem of historical materialism is the Eurocentrism I have already talked about earlier. So I won't go back in this. But what is interesting, or what is important in our argument, that is, of course, these three features of historical materialism are not only politically damaging, but also theoretical weakness. And Marx would not be a really interesting thinker if he would resume to the theory. But our argument is that Marx's work precisely does not resume to historical materialism. Quite on the contrary, in later periods of his intellectual production, Marx overcomes functionalist theology, anti-ethics, and Eurocentrism. So let me, as I already talked about Eurocentrism, elaborate a little on the two other aspects. When we take this functionalist theology, you can see that in wherever Marx does empirical work in the social sciences, this feature is not significant at all, quite the opposite. When you take, for instance, the 18th Brumaire, Marx clearly sees cultural semantics of France's revolutionary past as having a causal impact on with respect to social practices beyond any alleged functionality of the development of the productive forces. And his analysis, Marx conceives of action as a performative act in which significant practices relate to existing cultural expressions. Another example would be Capital, Volume 1, where Marx analyzes the mechanisms of the capitalist mode of production and evaluates also these mechanisms pretty normatively with concepts like despotism, exploitation, and so on and so forth, to say that those mechanisms are opposed to a good human life. And finally, Marx also completes his analysis with genealogical accounts of class struggle over the limits of the working day and also of the birth of capitalism. So none of these analyses can be seen as functionalist and theological as they have been in the 1850s. So the same kind of movement of overcoming can also be observed when you take this field of ethics or normative thinking. Take, for instance, the analysis of the Paris Commune of 1871. Here, Marx clearly advocates for a conception of radical democracy. He clearly describes what a post-capitalist political organization could look like. There is universal suffrage, imperative mandate of representatives, accountability and revocability. And with all these ideas, Marx is pretty far off his earlier historical philosophical considerations on politics. And the same movement, you can see it in his critique or his review of the Gotha program in 1875, where he clearly says that social and political justice does not appear as a somehow byproduct of historical and historically, philosophically guaranteed social change. Marx rather recognizes a need for a practical design of emancipatory institutions and genuine ethical reflections. So Urs Lindner and I argue that this weakness of historical materialism should be overcome, but it should be overcome with Marxism engaging seriously with other critical traditions, discourses like feminism, postcolonialism, or global history. And we would say that this is the challenge Marxism confronts in the 21st century.
And these are questions of periodization. I mean, I note in the book, I think it's in this essay or another one throughout the book, you sort of present a slightly qualified version of Althusser's epistemological break and indicate that there might be a different periodization. Does this suggest then that it's the later work of Marx that is the most important? Lots of his early writings, certainly some of his early writings, but lots of his later writings were unpublished, manuscripts, notes, excerpts that you discuss, and they don't seem to have the same degree of sophistication, some of them, and completion that Capital Volume 1 certainly would have had. So what do you think we can still learn from these more dispersed later writings that you discuss? And also, can I throw in there an extra little edge, which is, how does that fit into your periodization, your revised epistemological, or at least methodological break that you've been discussing?
Yeah. So when it comes to late Marx, I would say there's, first of all, something methodological we can learn from him, and something which is a little contrary to historical materialism, or at least was often misunderstood and resisted in historical Marxism, which is actually intellectual openness and political curiosity. You may see this when you are interested in the authors Marx was inspired, late Marx was inspired by. So there is Charles Darwin, there is Lewis Morgan, and there is Maxim Kowalewski. So Darwin was obviously the inventor of evolutionary biology. The other two are little less known. Morgan was this anthropologist focusing on native North American communities, and Kowalewski was a legal scholar from Russia working on landed property in the non-Western world. And Marx expands his view by working on these authors, and he also uses them for reconsidering certain formerly held beliefs. And of course, he did not do so by giving us a coherent and finished theory. And as you said, the major part of late Marx's work consists of manuscripts and excerpts and notes and so on. But it's interesting that lots of Marxists until today are not really interested in those, which is a little telling, as these manuscripts are obviously not suited for dogmatization and creating a canon. But what is also telling in late Marx is that he distanced himself pretty clearly from people that were starting at the time, by the end of his life, to reference to his work as a dogma. So there is this phrase, according to Engels, so this is not written by Marx, but Engels quotes Marx on this, where he said, Marx facing this dogmatic attitude, where he said, quote unquote, "If anything is certain, is that myself, I'm not a Marxist." So I guess this is really an important sign of him refusing all kind of dogmatism and being really, as I said earlier, intellectually open and politically curious. So the successive changes late Marx had realized in his work are pretty visible when you look, for instance, into Capital Volume 1, and especially into the revisions Marx has undertaken in different editions of it. So contrary to what I described as historical materialism earlier, Marx elaborates here a pretty differentiated conception of historical time. So when you take Capital Volume 1, how it was published in its first edition in 1867, Marx has this saying in the preface where, and I quote him on this, he says, the country, so this is a quote, the country that is more developed industrially only shows to the best, less developed, the image of its own future, end of quote. And when you see how this develops some years later, 5 years later in the French translation of his book, you see the same quote that is slightly modified, but meaningfully modified. Marx now says, introducing this idea of a past dependence, I quote him, the country that is developed industrially only shows to those who follow it on the industrial scale the image of its own future, end of quote. So here clearly is a pretty interesting shift in the conception of history that is important for late Marx. But there are also other examples where you can see that he opens up for considerations of contingency and different historical developments. He discards, for instance, the concept of feudalism as universal category, as it is underpinned by a certain pattern of Western historical development. And also in his famous letters to the Russian revolutionary Vera Sasulich from the early 1880s, Marx stresses the importance of what he called circumstances or historical surroundings of modes of production to concretely understand their articulation locally. And also, which is interesting in the same line of thought, he conceives of social progress not as a constant natural growth anymore. He rather appreciates certain forms of pre-capitalist social organization and sees the future of society, socialist or communist society, as what he calls a revival of a nascent equality in a somehow higher form, or a return to an archaic type of communal property. So I would say, when you look at the late Marx, that there is a growing sensibility for this, and it comes together with a growing sensibility of different forms of domination. So when you compare late Marx writings to his 1853 essays on colonialism, you can see that there's a much more differentiated account of colonialism here. For instance, Marx becomes critic of the idea of the absence of private landed property in the global South, an idea he clearly argued for in his 1853 essays, and he now identifies this same idea as being part of a colonial ideology, which supports colonial robbery of land. So clearly you have this more differentiated conception of time going together also with a growing sensibility of different types of domination.
Yeah, I think one of the outstanding things about this book is that it forms part of a longer tradition, which I think the Deutsche Prize has recognized, which is a close philological reading of Marx and contextualization, an understanding of Marx's oeuvre as something that is itself dynamic and dialectical. And that comes across a great deal in what you've been talking about. But I wanted to take us away now from what we've discussed thus far, which is one of the three areas that the book is concerned, namely Marxology, for want of a better word, towards the more political debates around Marxism and indeed its rivals in the form of post-colonial theory. So the last couple of questions, I want to ask you firstly about a chapter that, again, is very clearly entitled Global Challenges, Marxism, Eurocentrism, and Pluralism in the 21st Century. So maybe taking us more towards the politics of the book. What you discuss Marx and global affairs, global history, as we've been discussing, but it also addresses Marxist debates, the debates within Marxism around the legacy of these various canonical writings, their interpretation. And you emphasize across the various essays how this presents challenges. So what are those challenges for the 21st century? What is at stake in these debates amongst Marxists?
Yeah, you also, I somehow felt a certain frustration when I started working on this issue. So the frustration came from a pretty basic and it seemed to me superficial argument of lots of Marxists that argue that Marx's take on global affairs was one of an internationalist that hoped for a global revolution and that for, therefore Marx was not Eurocentric as he was interested in non-Western social conflict and history. And nobody can deny it. I mean, clearly Marx read numerous accounts of global affairs and he wrote extensively already in the 40s and 50s, especially in the 50s on non-Western matters. But the question that arises against the background of work that has been done in global history in the last 30 years or so is not only if Marx engaged with global affairs, but how he engaged with them. So what do I mean by that? Let me perhaps start with a quick reminder. So global history is a critique of the effacement of non-European history, or more precisely, the influence of European history and non-European history on European development. And so global history tries to carve out the importance of the non-Western world for the emergence of modernity. And that modernity, global history argues, is constituted in not from a sole point of view, from the European point, but in global relations. And therefore, Europe needs to be provincialized, to quote the famous title of Dipesh Chakrabarti's book, and this provincialization needs to be realized by writing a history of this intertwining of the European and the non-European world. So when we look at Marx's work through this lens of global history, we can see that in the 1850s and the 1860s, the author did not ascribe much of social agency to the non-Western world. For instance, when he comments on the Chinese Taiping Revolution, Marx presents this as a somehow inferior form or even a simple repetition of Western models. So there is this often quoted article on China of 1850, where he describes European reactionaries flying to China from a European revolution. And when they come to the Great Wall of China, they might find the following saying, République chinoise, liberté, égalité, fraternité. So Chinese Republic, liberty, equality, and fraternity, which is obviously the saying of the French Revolution. So here the Chinese Revolution is only modeled on the Western European model. And there's more. In the 1860s, especially in 1862, Marx calls China a quote-unquote living fossil. And the social Chinese social movements cannot claim any type of autonomy to Western modernity. So I would say that for quite a long time, Marx did not acknowledge the non-European world as being part of a global political interaction that had outcomes for either part in this relation, for instance, China and Europe. China and countries outside the West, the global South, more generally, are seen somehow as a resonating chamber that only receives like input from the Western world and that might then influence back on the metropole. But this backfiring, he also it says pretty clearly in lots of articles written on economic issues, is conceived pretty exclusively economic. So there is no political creativity in these uprisings in the global south. And once again, I think this perspective changes in later works, but what is really interesting when you look in this question is that lots of Marxist authors do not really understand what global history here is and its critique of Eurocentrism is really about. So when this critique is taken seriously, one cannot simply reject the critique of Eurocentrism by saying, okay, Marx was interested in the non-Western world, and lots of his writings on world areas prove this. So let me give another example for this type of ignorance of the critique of Eurocentrism that is made in global history. Last year, I wrote a long review essay for the French journal Raison Politique on a dictionary which is entitled Histoire globale des socialismes in French, Global History of Socialisms, and its editors, which are three French Marxists, not only largely ignore emancipatory movements from the non-Western world, but they also conceive of socialism. And this is pretty amazing when you refer to global history as a European product which was exported to other world regions. Global history, in contrast to this idea, moves beyond this kind of obsession with socialism's European origins and carves out some processes of hybridization that take place between metropole and colony, to quote the famous essay of historian Anne-Laurent Stoller and Frederick Cooper. So global history is interested in this hybridization, but it also tries to contextualize the impact of European socialist ideas in, let's say, Asia, in a materialist way. It does so by considering that this reception is a result of social changes that have created the condition under which the reading of European authors in the non-Western world began to make political sense. So anyway, the whole approach of this dictionary, Struggle by the Socialism, is ignoring what global history is ultimately about, but it's not the fault of this dictionary, but it's more the general ignorance of which this publication is, for me at least, somehow illustrating, which is symptomatic for a larger Marxist discourse. And so to answer your question, I feel like there are more problems than really achievement in recent Marxist publications on global issues and on Eurocentrism.
So that includes, and to start to wind up, Vivek Chiba, whose work, there's a recent critique of post-colonial theory you dedicate a whole chapter to. But when I mention Chiba, I also think of maybe Kevin Anderson or even in the 90s, Ijaz Ahmed, more recently, Irfan Habib, those kinds of, I think, sympathetic critics of your position. Well, the latter certainly perhaps are closer to that more philological understanding. Where do you sit in those kind of more recent debates? If we focus on Chiba, maybe also bring in Anderson's book. How do you situate your own work in those interventions on the themes of Eurocentrism and Marxism?
Yeah, perhaps I should say first of all that I completely welcome the growing interest, which is also illustrated by these two publications, in Marxist theory in global affairs, even though I somehow feel that both of these publications deserve what I am advocating for, which is a differentiated debate on post-colonialism within Marxist theory. So Anderson's book is known by lots of people, is a somehow encyclopedic study of Marxist texts on the non-Western world. And it's a little tricky, as I would say, Anderson lacks somehow a sophisticated theoretical attitude, which is also illustrated by his book from 2005 on the Iranian Revolution and Foucault. But to put this aside, I would say the same applies to his book, Marx at the Margin, as Anderson rejects all of post-colonial criticisms by arguing, as I criticized it earlier, that Marx was not Eurocentric because actually he was interested in the margins of Western society and that he has written extensively on those. And I have argued in a long paper published last year in the French journal Contretemps that Anderson's view lacks a comprehensive engagement with different forms of Eurocentrism. I have argued for earlier. So let me give two examples for this. First, Anderson praises Marx's support for the Indian independence in the 1850s. And what I would say is that he thereby completely ignores that Marx's positive mentions of the Indian struggle are completely enshrined in a Eurocentric perspective I talked about earlier. So his view, even though he underlines the importance of the Indian independence struggle, does not ascribe agency to the colonized, but conceives of the West as the sole driver of history. So according to Marx, there is somehow a cunning of history that English colonialism pushes India forward in terms of historical development, and that Indians can harvest the fruits planted by the British Empire. And this is not only a counterfactual vision of things. Marx himself recognized later in his work, but it is also completely inscribed into this philosophy of history I have pointed out as a an important figure of historical materialism. A second example, which is pretty telling in Anderson's book, is for his lack of engagement with different critics of Eurocentrism, is that he tries to value a multilinear perspective of Marx on the development of capitalist societies by making a positive reference to the Asiatic mode of production. So Anderson positively referenced to the Asiatic mode of production to counter a Stalinist view of historical development. To remember the listeners, so Stalin had this idea of five main types of the relations of production that shape the course of human history. So Stalin writes about the primitive communal, the slave, the feudal, the capitalist, the socialist modes of production. And Anderson tries to say, okay, this Marx has a more differentiated view on historical development as he introduced the Asiatic type. But what Anderson's reference to the Asiatic mode of production actually does is illustrating once again that he ignores one type of Eurocentrism, which is Orientalism, as critical authors such as Perry Anderson, and especially a book which is unfortunately a little forgotten in the Marxist debate, Brendan O'Leary, have shown that the idea of an Asiatic mode of production is completely grounded in biased Western colonial sources. And so to claim that the Asiatic mode is a production of production is a proof of sophistication in Marx's theory of history is just playing one type of Eurocentrism against another. So I felt also a little frustrated with this approach to Marx's engagement with global affairs. When it comes to Schiffer's book, Postcolonial Theory and the Spectre of Capital, I think, first of all, I need to say that it is the most vigorous Marxist critique of postcolonial studies that is currently available. And this is also the reason I devoted a chapter to this book. And Schiffer clearly is making a more differentiated contribution to the discussion on the relationship between Marxism and postcolonialism. Nevertheless, I would say that he contributes also to an unproductive polarization in this field, as he implicitly asserts the validity of Marx's analysis of capitalism on a global scale, despite not addressing inherent issues within it. And here again, perhaps two examples. So Schipper first criticizes subaltern studies for sharing what he calls the conventional story of colonial and capitalist modernization of countries in the global south. And this conventional stories, following subaltern studies, is a Marxist meta-narrative of a homogenizing capitalist drive. And subaltern studies argue that this drive can not be observed actually in India, and historical difference characterizes historical development in India, and no unifying capitalist drive. So now I would say that Schipper is pretty right to reject this conception of a schematic and theological development from pre-capitalist to capitalist society that is entailed in this idea of a conventional story. But the problem is that this conception is not absent from Marx's work, as I have argued earlier, especially in the chapter on his historical materialism. And when rejecting the whole of the critique, subaltern studies are addressing to Marx's theory in this respect, it seems to me a little dishonest, at least, to say that this does not play a role in Marxist theory. And the second point would be that according to subaltern studies, Marxism advocates for a concept of capitalism that presupposes a fundamental transformation of cultural, social, and political practices once capital is introduced effectively in a society. So subaltern studies draw from this idea that the continuing existence of pre-capitalist forms of domination in the global south is a proof of Eurocentrism within a Marxist theory of capitalism. And here again, Schipper pretty rightly argues that capitalism is not simply this unifying, homogenizing drive, but on the contrary, that capitalism builds up and uses historical difference to prosper. But once again, this argument is dishonest when it comes to the Marxian tradition, as Marx himself, for instance, saw the existence of free labor as a condition of capitalism. And this type of free labor is pretty rare in the global south. And also Marx argued for a pretty ambivalent concept of abstract labor that had, as especially the Russian tradition after Rubin pointed out, had physiological elements in it, and therefore makes an understanding and rejection of abstract labor that is present in subaltern studies somehow rational. Subaltern studies argue that the empirical transformation of work abstract labor would entail can actually not be observed in the global south, and that is to say that this absence would illustrate the impossible possibility of Marx's critique of political economy to grasp capitalism outside of the West. And here again, I see some problems within Marx's theory itself. So these are just two examples where I would say Schipper is a little too generous with the Marxian tradition or perhaps fails even to develop a real critical view of that tradition, even though his arguments against the subaltern view might be overall true. And perhaps to come to an end, I would say this critical perspective on Marx and Marxism is really paramount for a differentiated debate. And this perspective, my book, Marx, Marxism, and the Question of Eurocentrism, is devoted.
Thanks so much, Kolya. I mean, I think we've got a taste of the richness of the book. I should add that one of the chapters from memory involves a discussion with some other colleagues, which is a sort of extra bonus, the chapter on Marx, Universalism, and the Global South. So I think certainly on my reading, it's a book that opens up debates. It enlightens us about the past, both in Marx's writings and those that have interpreted him, but critically is very much about now and about the unevenness of capitalism and about the political conjunctures that throws up for you know, Marxists and broader leftists in general. So I want to thank you for writing the book. I want to congratulate you on it. And I'm going to leave with a very final, slightly banal question, but which is, on all this stuff that you've had to read and all this work, would there be a single book that you'd recommend us to pick up apart from Chibber or Anderson's? Is there a book on these broad themes or an essay even that you've come across that you'd say you must read this?
Yeah, actually there is, and it's a brand new book, so you give me the opportunity to make some advertisement of a colleague's work. And actually this colleague was also present into the discussion I included in the last chapter of my book, and this colleague is from India. His name is Aditya Nigam, and he just published in the same book series, so Marx, Engels, and Marxisms, a book that is entitled Border Marxisms and Historical Materialism, Untimely Encounters. I had the chance to read two or three chapters before Aditya sent it to the publisher, and I can highly recommend it, as it is a genuinely interesting perspective on issues I also discuss in my book. And Aditya is this great scholar, Marxist scholar from India, we can learn a lot from. So yeah, I would really recommend anybody to read this book. I would really recommend everybody to read this book.
Thank you so much, Holger.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much, Kolya and Alex, for that stimulating conversation. But this sadly concludes our second season of Marxism in Our Times, which we hope you enjoyed as much as us. We also hope to see you in person in the next Deutscher lecture at the 20th Annual Conference of Historical Materialism, where, as you know, the winner for this year will give a lecture regarding their work, if you happen to be in London. Also, as always, remember that you can find more information about the Deutscher Prize and how to nominate titles for it at our website linked below. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next year.